Welcome to The Jewish Diasporist, a podcast exploring the political, social, and cultural implications of life in diaspora. We are your hosts, Ben Yenowitz
and Zach Smarin. For this episode, we spoke to Oli Schwartz, a brilliant cultural organizer who founded Pushkart Judaica, an online and traveling market that specializes in ethical Judaica produced by local artists and makers.
I met Oli during the Center for Jewish Nonviolence's May 2023 delegation to Palestine, see episode 7 for more, where they introduced themselves to me as a fellow diasporist. From 2018 to 2022, Oli served as one of the co-directors of Linka Flegel, Yiddish for Left Wing, which was a queer diasporist chicken farm in upstate New York that intentionally built community for 1 7-year Shemitah cycle.
Oli is currently in their podcast era. They were recently featured in an episode of the Judaism Unbound podcast. While we recommend you check out that episode after you listen to ours, the framing of our conversation around diasporism across the world offers something unique. No matter where you are, you should check out the website pushkartjudaica.com. The link will be in the description.
Thank you so much to our donors and audience. The Jewish Diasporist continues to be a passion project, fueled by your continual engagement and support. Please rate our show on your podcast platform of choice. Consider supporting us on Patreon, which helps us to continue producing this show. Follow us on Instagram. And most importantly, share our content with your friends and communities.
Without further ado, we hope you enjoyed the conversation.
We are beautiful people.
Welcome, Oli. It's a really great privilege to have you on the show. It's been a long time coming. We're really, really happy to have you here with us. To begin, could you tell us a little bit about your relationship to Jewishness and Jewish identity and what brings you to the work that you've been doing?
Sure. So excited to be with you all in this international conversation about Jewishness, Judaica, diasporism, arts and culture. I agree. We're long overdue for our conversation. So thanks for having me. Yeah, I love that question. Like, what brings me to the work I do? And I think there's some short answers to the question. And then there's a longer story. The longer story begins beyond the pale, not in this country, but with my great grandparents who immigrated in the early 1900s to the Lower East Side, which is where both sides of my family kind of orbited until I came into the world. And I feel grateful that I got to grow up in a place where being Jewish wasn't necessarily an exception. New York City is such a specific cultural location. And I think without knowing it, there's a way in which it was the only place where my peoples on both sides of my family had rooted in their own relationship to being in diaspora. And I grew up in a conservative shul and felt pretty connected to being Jewish as a young person. But then I joke that like my queerness or my like relationship to learning about climate change or racism as like a person growing up in the 90s and early 2000s was a gateway to maybe asking questions that my congregation wasn't ready for or like felt like I was really invested in answers to and I wasn't getting those answers in my synagogue. And so like in my early, pretty much after my B'nai Mitzvah, I was like trying to hang in there and I was just like, I really don't see the questions that I need answers to being answered around like, what is radical inclusion look like? What is caring for the planet? And like, how does my spiritual lineage of Judaism relate to like how we should care about the fact that the planet is on fire? I was born in the age of like the Al Gore movie. And I actually like, it's embarrassing to say, but that like fully politicized me as a young teenager. I had the Melissa Etheridge soundtrack. It really got me as a young gay. Yeah. So I was like part of the youth climate movements that were happening in DC in the early 2000s. And I kind of just left Judaism behind because at the time it just didn't seem like a place where like answers or resilience or resourcing could happen around these like truly burning questions about equity and like the future of humanity. And then after the like Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, which happened
2017.
Thank you. Yeah. I kind of had a realization that as I was reading more and more about how we reached this moment of like nascent rise of fascism, how much anti-Semitism and particularly like white Ashkenazi assimilation into whiteness in the United States was like at the crux of modern anti-Black racism in the US. And it like shook me to my core. I was like, oh, wow. So much of reading the actual like playbook, so to speak, or I think they called it a style guide at that point that had launched like around the Unite the Right rally was like deeply rooted in like Jews' role in basically like complicity with or not complicity with whiteness. And that like we had a role, I had a role to play in understanding my own people's assimilation and what it would mean to like refuse that and what it would mean to refuse that in relationship with my own anti-racism work in my community that I was a part of at that time. And so like in my community, I was like, okay, we need to talk about this. Like we need to talk about this together. I feel kind of alone. Like, is anyone else on the same page about what's happening here? And we decided to have a Shabbat, which at that time, like not a lot of us were practicing. I think we like found our way to some candles and that was kind of it. But in that dinner together, we were like, hey, I think maybe there's some other Jews who live in this neighborhood. Like, hey, I think maybe like this Shabbat thing could really support us. And like something happened where we kind of made like an unspoken commitment to try to find our way back into Judaism as part of our justice work. And from that moment on, Shabbats happened twice a month until the pandemic.
Wow.
What gives me goosebumps about that specific story is that I was part of redistribution movements. I was part of supporting youth of color farming in our region and like quote unquote food desert action and stuff like that. There was a lot happening around eviction. Like a lot of people in my community were like deeply involved in organizing. And then like once we started having Shabbat, I looked around and all the white people in this, most of the white people, I should say, in the meetings I would be at during the day in the week were like at Shabbat on Friday night. And I was like, you know, it's not like there's a inherent connection or a like fetishizing or a nostalgia that I want to make about Jews and our commitment or lack thereof to justice work. But what like shook me was like how I didn't understand that actually like from a cultural standpoint, a lot of us were coming to our organizing work in part because we were Jewish, but until that Shabbat in 2017, like we had not talked about it. To me, there's anti-Semitism in that. There's like assimilation in that. There's severing from our tradition. There's like not understanding how Judaism could resource us. So that's like one piece of the long story that I was able to come back around to what I already knew and had because I could see a path for myself.
Thank you for that introduction. I think that's really powerful and different from my own experience and very similar at the same time, because I think for a lot of people, like I'm a little bit younger than you, I kind of had that sort of disillusionment with Judaism, not on climate change, not on anything like that, but on Zionism and thinking through and unlearning the narratives that we were taught around that and then having that same sort of break, focusing on justice work instead and then kind of finding your way back to Judaism in a roundabout way. But I think what you spoke about just now speaks to this idea of de-assimilation, which I think I've heard you talk about before. Could you say a little bit about what de-assimilation means to you and how your work kind of fits into that idea?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's helpful to think about what assimilation is and then what the opposite of that could be or what resistance to that could be. And in my very brief, humble understanding in my own lived experience of what assimilation for my family or my community that I'm now a part of as a young adult and now an adult is like both not knowing for many people, like what are the rhythms of Jewish time? What are our ways of marking sacred space? Or what are our holidays? What are our prayers for any given moment in our lives that could help us feel supported in being human and how hard that is? Mm-hmm. And also for some of us, knowing but choosing not to relate to or feel connection with what it could mean to practice Shabbat in any range of ways, what it could mean to wear ritual objects like tzitzit or to don tefillin or kippah, like head covering. So I think there's like things we don't know. And then there's things we know that sometimes it feels like to choose them would be sacrificing coolness, social capital, relationship and access to privilege of whiteness, relationship and access to feeling fine with the Christian hegemonic dominant schedule. So I think for me, there's like a combination growing up conservative of like some things I knew and was choosing choosing to ignore or not engage with, and some things that I like fully did not know. I think there are a lot of ways that the conservative movement, and not just, I think most modern synagogue movements and ways of educating young people, are like pretty disconnected from what would actually be supportive for us. So if that's assimilation, then could de-assimilation be like choosing choicefully to align with my tradition, despite what it may mean for other people who love me and then will feel disconnected from me, or people who straight up will then see me as something that I'm not, or put something on me based on anti-Semitism or the ways that Zionism is now conflated with the Jewish people, which is like, I think, not a whole explanation, but a very small piece of what de-assimilation could look like in everyday life.
When it comes to discussions on assimilation, something that is quite relevant towards many Western European Jewish communities, but particularly in the Anglo-American world, is also this idea that after the Second World War, less and less Jews begin to assimilate, not only through visibility and their culture, but also becoming the backbone of the American or British middle class, becoming more suburbanized. You have a move away from the Jewish street being the place that is where the Jewish community meets and takes place. And it's more and more the question of suburban families driving by car to go to synagogue, and religious buildings and movements being the only places where Jewish identity can become, and the invisibilization of Jewish workers, which is something that, you know, if the term working class in many countries of the Western world is considered passé, then the idea of a Jewish working class is completely fantastical when it comes to the modern idea of it. I obviously don't agree with that. We've spoken about this before when we spoke with Ross from the Melbourne Bund, or with Laura Jaffe and Ellie Flores for our episode 21, I believe, when we talked about labour organising. But in terms of how this relates to the kind of work that you do, on your Instagram you mentioned that you see the pushcart as a symbol of survival, creativity and adaptability among Jews on Turtle Island, that's the American continent, who are not allowed to own land or businesses. Again, in the context of a very, very different Jewish communal identity. And I, as someone who chooses to wear a kippah, I wear a kamay, I'm very visibly Jewish, and I'm part of, you know, revitalizing, rebuilding Jewish communal life. When it comes to Bundist organizing, that also gives a certain sense of Jewish autonomy in socialist and progressive movements and spaces. But this has to be done in very different ways, and not romanticizing the past necessarily, or thinking that we can go back to what it was. So within that context, and for the audience who is just listening and can't see this, Ollie is nodding along to what I'm saying. What do you think is the significance of the pushcart as a symbol today? I mean, Jews are legally allowed to own land and businesses. So do you think that there's a way of connecting to that legacy without it becoming romanticized and a false beacon of and direction of what you think we should do?
Yes, I'm so glad you brought class into the conversation. I think that's so important when we think about how we choose to live our lives and what stakes there are for different peoples, and just honoring that that is a super complicated question. And also, I was chuckling to myself as you were describing the specific so-called American experience of the way that class intersected with Jews in this idea of the middle class, because that is on my patrilineal side of my family. There was a move to Cherry Hill, New Jersey, which is one of those cul-de-sac suburbs right outside the city. And when asking my family about that experience and what it was like to live there, why did you move, all these things, it was interesting to hear the undertones of what it meant to choose to really move away from a place where there was a Jewish social life, and a loss in that. And like, okay, we had these synagogues that we were making, but like you said, it's a completely different landscape on every level. And then my dad moved back to New York, which I just think is an interesting part of that whole story. And I'm like curious, yeah, my life would be so different had he stayed somewhere else that was suburban, then choose to move back to where his family was from before that point. But in answer to your question about the symbol of the pushcart itself and resisting nostalgia, which I really appreciate you saying, because when we talk about revival or reconnection, I'm never interested in romanticization or a nostalgic understanding of what we should be doing to reconnect. We are living in a different context, and to believe that we should or we want to go back to the past doesn't align with my own values of what it means to grapple with the present, and also to be sensitive to the fact that the past, in many respects, is a really bad place for a lot of people who I care about for a lot of reasons. And to say that nostalgia in my own learnings from particularly Matilda Bernstein Sycamore, who is a queer trans writer who writes a lot about nostalgia, not in a religious context, but what she speaks about is how it really flattens the violence that was present in any time when we lean on nostalgia. We lose all of our critical thinking about the moment. So I'm grateful for you bringing that piece in. And so when I say that pushcart itself is an important symbol, I mean that there's a relational aspect to the social sphere that Jews were living in at that time that I think is badly needed for like human health, not just for Jews, but for all people, like meeting one's neighbors, living in a place where it feels like you could let your kids be on the street or you could glance across the way and know the person across the way and care about them. There's like the literal social sphere that I think the pushcart existed in that also had like no sanitation and like all these horrible things that I'm not interested in carrying forward. But what I am interested in is how that socially there was a connection between the literal needs of people for food, candy, ritual items. Typically, like we're thinking about like pretzels, cigars, and pickles. And that's what my great-great-grandpa Lewis was part of that pushcart moment. But like they're getting their needs met in a social way where like either they know the person making the thing or they know the person who's delivering them the object. Like, I'm not a Marxist or anything, but I am interested in the way that production impacts our relationships with what we have. And also, maybe not in any way, but a different conversation. Our relationship with the objects we have impacts our entire way that we understand the world. And so I think in that moment, there was a much deeper relationship with the objects and the people happening in that community that I'm interested in.
I wrote my dissertation on the subject of Jewish worker cooperatives and specifically the impact that they had on Jewish communal revitalization in Poland after the Second World War and that connection that exists with production and a form of alienation, if we don't want to go too Marxist on it, but I think there is something to say about who produces the thing. When you receive a product, you are a consumer of it, but do you have a connection with the people that produce it? I think that's very important as well. I'll say this again because I've just been walking around Kazimierz quite a lot in the last few days and weeks.
Kazimierz being the Jewish quarter in Krakow, for those that might not know.
That's right. It's not just the case of, you know, people moving out and suburbanization. In Kazimierz, there are specific issues relating to tourism and predominantly like gastronomy and nightclubs that are connected with it. But one thing that strikes me more and more when I go in there is just how many goddamn parking lots there are. It's really obscene. The main space where Jewish communal life existed for hundreds, if not thousands of years, was the street. It was not the synagogue. It was the street. There's this whole idea that also exists in Jewish socialist and progressive movements of in die Gassen zu die Massen, in the streets to the masses, in alle Gassen, the song, in all the streets, and the Jewish street itself being a space. And when you look at Szeroka Street, and apart from many other things that you can take issue with, the fact that it's packed with cars, that does not foster a good communal environment, whether Jewish or not, or mixed.
Part of what I feel like this project is able to mobilize for Jewish people interested in arts, culture, and what it means to have a Judaism that meets this moment is that there's a place for all people's gifts. The like story that I like to tell about pushcart specifically is that people are like, oh yeah, I make art, but like, I don't know about Jewish art. And then they see, oh, pushcart's coming to my town. All of a sudden they've made 200 candles. They've made 40 candle holders. They now make ketubas. Like, it's interesting the ways in which actually people are waiting or like our human need to connect with either our spiritual tradition or feel connected to a community. And I think the markets that I'm able to have in different parts of the country basically replicate the street feeling, not in a nostalgic way, but in a way that's like, this is what we have now, and I want you to meet each other, and I want you to feel empowered with the gifts and skills that you have. So for 5 hours, we're going to have this street, this market. And also just to say that like the gift that I hear you bring, Zach, is like, yes, there's historical precedent and there's an analysis of what is lost. And what is lost is not simply like poof into thin air. There are reasons that are structural, both literally the street and the cars and interpersonal. And I'm grateful for the ways that you're able to articulate things that I think this project is speaking to that I myself haven't had access to or my own pathway in to spend the time to do that research. But what I hear and what you're saying is like, yeah, the deep foundations for how we got to where we are and like, okay, so where do we go from here? Which I think is a larger question of this project. Like, okay, here we are, but actually there are some pathways in, and that's what I'm interested in. So thanks for that.
So you're actually coming to where I am in November in Santa Cruz, California, and I'm really, really looking forward to that. I'm in a very strange position where I'm working at the main synagogue. It's like a small community, so we have one big synagogue, and then I'm also having close relationships with people outside the synagogue, and like the Santa Cruz Jews for a Free Palestine, or the Tzim Tzum Collective, these other groups that are largely splitting off and actually often like directly opposed to the main synagogue where I've been working. But when I talk to people both inside the synagogue and outside the synagogue, they're really excited to have you come, because I do think there is something about the cultural work that you're doing that speaks to a very clear demand for something that can be understood from a variety of ideological positions, whether it's just like, we want more Jewish culture, or we want a clear liberatory framework for the way we do this work. And that's really, really beautiful. But I was actually thinking about how your family history, where you have grandparents or parents who left New York City and then came back, and you were saying something about how you would be amazed to see how different your life would be had that not happened. And I was just thinking about that from my family's history. Of course, my family, like most Jewish families, were in New York City for a while, but they did leave. My grandparents ended up in suburban locales, whether it was the suburbs of Sacramento or the suburbs of Salt Lake City, where the only form of Jewish communal life was synagogue-based. And you can really see the way it shapes a Jewish identity that is increasingly exclusive. And in my own life, I've seen, I mean, it's a very white synagogue. It's a very white community. So Jews of color, whether they're Black Jews or Sephardi Mizrahi Jews, have been kind of marginalized in these spaces. And even if like there's a lot of lip service paid to queer and trans Jews, I've seen it in practice that is very much marginalized as well. There's a lot of liberals who are like, yeah, I support trans rights. And then it's their kid. And they're like, oh, I'm not going to actually call you by your pronouns. I'm going to dead name you. And it's really, really sad to see. But it also, I think, speaks to the sort of work you're doing and the need for it. In your own work, I've seen that you really try to uplift these people on the fringes of the community that are marginalized by these mainstream spaces. And I was wondering how you actually do that in your work and why you see that as so central to this sort of liberatory politics that you center in your project.
Yeah, so you asked a practical question of like, how to uplift those on the fringes of the Jewish community. And I think there are some practical answers, which are that like, I have an online store. And for me, there is a strong focus for that store. And those are the things that you would not be able to get if you went to, I guess I live on the East Coast, so like the Boston Judaica store, which I've gone to, you know, just as a Jew needing things in my past life. And also for maybe you would call it market or cultural research. And I think there's a lot, you know, in some ways, there's like plenty of Judaica out there. In some ways, not everything, but like if you wanted a menorah, you could get it on Etsy. You could get it at a Judaica store, brick and mortar store, the ones that are left. However, like if you wanted one that was made with the clay underneath the demolished police station that represents like a turning moment in my town, putting resources toward the police here, you probably couldn't get that one without my I don't even think I sell that one, but I do have that in my own house. By which I mean that like there are certain Judaica that many people in my community and communities across the country, and I would say the world, need to be able to say, I can turn to this tradition to resource me. This tradition makes sense to carry forward. This tradition reflects who I am. This tradition is calling on me to act in alignment with my values. And that Judaica is made by people on the fringes of our community. People who are asking hard questions about inclusion, about what it means to keep things and to adapt them, which Jews have a lively debates about across the board. But I would say those conversations are really different depending where you are. So I would say that like I have a really strong commitment to seeking out and uplifting Judaica that you just don't see other places. And I think that's what makes the store really supportive for people and also very different from what else may be out there. And I would say like people would be like, well, how do you find those people? And I'm like, well, I'm a practicing Jew and I'm a Jew who lives on the fringes in some ways politically, in some ways in my embodied lived experience. So like those are my people. We're connected. So in that way, it feels like a joy. I feel like sometimes my job is just gassing people up. I'm like, I've seen your work. It's amazing. Let's do this. And they're like, really? Me? You know, the like, quote, Jewish enough question. Or in the arts world, there's like, am I like a good enough artist? And I'm here to be like, yes. I mean, of course, I don't take everything and anything. But like, it feels so clear to me when I see things that I'm like, yeah, people need that. People need that to survive. People need that to stay in the streets. People need that to stay in their bed and feel connected, even though they're in isolation. Like, people need that. So I would say that's like the tachlis or practical logistical part of how I do my work, which also is just like a lot of meetings, a lot of hustle, a lot of gassing people up, a lot of time, which like can be hard, but also it feels like very, very fulfilling and nourishing for me. And then I think you asked a good question, which was like, okay, why? Which I answered a little bit in the how, but I think also like, if we look back in time at Jewish tradition, at people who are prophets in our origin story in the Torah, or even in anthropologized recordings of Jewish practices across time before a complete and total diaspora into modern United States or modern UK world, we're looking at like, whatever, sources from 17, 1800s, like who do we see carrying some of the most sacred traditions forward? It is like women. It is like trans people, but they're not called that. It is like people who have probably like different relationships to reality than perhaps me and you, who are like standing in the graveyards and they're like, hey, you need me to weep for you? Give me that money. Like, that's my job. So I think it's like both funny and like so serious that I'm like, who is in touch with divine source? Who is like equipped to face the intensity of the reckoning of any given moment in time? It's like people on the margins of the community. So it's important to me to like uplift their many different, like, I feel like Annie Cohen's work and a lot of other people that we could like turn to that my brain can't cite right now, who are like, actually, who is here doing this work and like carrying forward these chains to be unbroken? It was like people who are marginalized. So I think that's like both a beautiful gift and can be challenging as we're talking about like who is uplifted, who's given resources, who can come to pray with other people and not be alone.
I feel that we should start a bingo game, to be honest, of how many times Annie Cohen gets mentioned on this podcast. Annie Cohen being my first Yiddish class teacher. But how many times Annie Cohen gets mentioned before we actually get Annie Cohen on. I feel this is probably the third or fourth time, which just shows to you the importance of her work. We've talked about Jewish culture a few times already as an important part of organizing on a diaspora, as in we had it as the main subject of the episode in a few different ways. We've spoken about music. Before this episode gets released, we have a discussion coming on Yiddish as a language. The kind of work that comes with what Pushkot does is to do with aesthetics and fashion. We're a bit debating whether fashion is the right word to describe quite a bit of this stuff. So perhaps you can tell us more about it. But how do you see these forms of culture in terms of Jewish visibility regarding de-assimilation? And to what extent do you think that this is important towards building the radical Jewish left?
You were like, is fashion the right word? I'm never against fashion. And one term that's been supportive to me is thinking in terms of adornment, whether that be like for our bodies or for our houses, for our Torahs, for our Megillot, for our scrolls. Like in our tradition, what sanctifies something as holy often has to do with how many rules there are about how it's made. And then also like, what do we do with it when we're not using it? Like, how do we adorn it? If it were a living being, like how would it know that it was regal, but perhaps not in a monarchist way, if you're asking me. But then you just said, why is adornment aesthetic? The arts, perhaps we could expand it that widely, important to Jewish movements for liberation. And maybe it's important to just say, like, in general, liberation movements organizing. And a conversation that I have a lot, both in putting ritual objects for sale on my website, deciding the price, in talking with a maker about what their creations are worth, is like, there is a massive devaluation of cultural production that is not unique to this moment. It's not something I've studied the history of, but earlier in this conversation, we were talking about like alienation from production. And I think in addition to that comes like a normalization of things being fast and cheap. That is the water we're swimming in. So then when something comes along that takes longer, like, oh, we've made 3 sets of vegan tefillin ever and we fast for 5 days and bury it in the ground, like that is not Amazon. So there's a larger conversation about what it means to value culture, both with patience and with resourcing that is financial. But I think because we live in a world where money is one of the predominant ways that we see value, unfortunately, like subconsciously, we're all being told like this thing is worth nothing. You should play the song on Spotify and you should not have to pay for it ever. That's an absurd concept that you would even pay for it. So I think there's like some work that we all have to do to realize and see where culture is in our lives that maybe we are taking for granted or we see as the backdrop that is actually not a backdrop, but a foundation. Like thinking about for many people, music. music. It's like people don't go a day without music often, or like we use music in very important moments in our lives. And yet it's free. We're never going to like compensate the person who made it, and neither should the structures of production compensate them very well. That's an example of an ephemeral adornment. I would say it's not physical, but I think it's a great example because it's one that we all have used in our lives. Whereas something like tefillin, which we historically would adorn ourselves with scripture on our heads and on our arms, depending on your gender, depending on how you practice Judaism in the mornings on most days that are not Shabbat, like not everybody can relate to that as an object that they want to use. And yet I would say, what does it mean when everyone has access to that cultural object? I've been in spaces where like there was tefillin wrapping workshops happening where people of all genders were having access to something that they physically may not have access to the thing, or they have been told or send messages that they are not religious enough or not the right gender to use the object at all in a ritual capacity. And I'm making the connection to organizing because I think if I feel that I can wrap tefillin and I have access to tefillin that aligns with my values, whether that's vegan or made of roadkill, or made by someone and in a production process that feels ethical to me, whatever that means. And that's the thing that I can put on my body every day. Like, what is that going to enable me to do with the rest of my day if that's how I start my day? Which is a question with many answers, but I think it's like an interesting example.
I also think it does speak to the idea of de-assimilation, of the way that cultural objects, whether it's ritual objects or art or even food, can play in this idea of breaking with the dominant white culture in American society or wherever you might be, and instead helping you connect to a cultural Jewish identity, which I think when we're really stuck with, I mean, traditional Reform Judaism saw Judaism just as a religious identity rather than a cultural identity. So I do think this often does play a big role in kind of reframing our Jewishness, helping us understand what Judaism or Jewishness means in the modern context beyond that religious identity. Just to move forward, I already said that you're going to be coming to Santa Cruz in November, and we're really looking forward to it. But I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what a pushcart market actually looks like. What sort of sights, what smells, what art can we expect to find there? I know you also offer educational programming. How do you see these events challenging nationalist conceptions of Jewish self-determination in their own communities? Two-parter as well.
Great. Yes, this is a good two-parter. Let's talk about what a market's like. My dream markets happen either in public spaces like a parking lot or a park, or in like art spaces or social spaces like a brewery, even though oftentimes I partner and work closely with synagogues or other Jewish groups to make sure that the market goes well and is something that works for the community that I'm visiting. It's important to me actually that they happen, as Zach said, in the streets, so to speak, for a number of reasons. One, it's like some people don't want to go into a synagogue. That's not going to work for them. And that means that they can still absolutely, in my opinion, be Jewish and connect to their Judaism. Also, like, I'm not going to do it in a church, which is a lot of the other free space available in America due to the way that buildings have been resourced or not resourced. A lot of the times it's like, yeah, the only free place is a church. And I'm not going to do that because, not that I don't believe in interfaith solidarity, but like, I do think a lot of Jewish life and all peoples who are not Christian deal with a lot of like Christian imagery and Christian dominance in our lives that I'm like, we could do without that for this one moment in time. So that's like how I like to think about public space or taking up space, is like, what is actually a different conception of Judaism that's more in alignment with culture than it is like a specific religious institution? And at the markets, I love for there to be local music playing. Oftentimes we have like local klezmer bands or Sephardi musicians, and that has been super awesome. Other things that happen are that there's like food. We've got, where I live, I have my amazing Knish queen. Shout out to Shula Pesach. But in other places, we've had babka or bagels, or honestly, just like Jewish people who love to cook, and food is a huge part of our tradition, and it's great to have food there.
I'll offer to make bagels when you come to Santa Cruz because I've been making a massive amount and it'd be great.
Oh my gosh, I'm so excited to eat your bagel. That's amazing, man. Yeah, so we usually have food, music in the streets, and then there's just a lot of vendors, and my call for vendors is very widespread. I want people to be there who want to be seen in their community or want to offer themselves to their community as like makers, Jewish makers. As I said before, oftentimes it's people's first time and then I'm like checking in with them. How did it go? They're like, I sold out. So I think there's like a true hunger for both ritual objects and just cultural production, posters, postcards, stickers. Like people are trying to connect with culture beyond prayer. And I personally love prayer, but I think there are a lot of ways that we can have inroads to who we are, where we come from, which is many multiplicities of things. But I think that the markets are really showing that like culture and arts are actually a huge part of Judaism that I would say like Western science heavy culture has said to us that like, it doesn't matter that there's arts here. It doesn't matter that there's like finery and like craft here. That doesn't matter. When in fact, like actually our tradition heavily relies on those makers and they've just been like invisibilized or outsourced to other countries. Yeah, so the market is just a good time, which I think has been interesting and challenging. For example, like I'm coming to you, Ben, after the election, and like I believe it's important to have a good time, even in hard times, but I'm interested in like what it means to gather in semi-public space as Jews when things are not going awesome, and that's an important moment to be gathering. So I am working to like think about what the markets look like as the election comes up and as the war has been ongoing as well. And I don't know if you still want me to go with the second question.
Yeah, I'd really love if you'd tackle that second question. It is kind of more theoretical.
Yeah. How do you see these events challenging? Yeah, thank you. So your namesake, the diasporist, in some ways, really speaks to what it means to gather where one lives and declare that a thriving community, or if it's not already one, to put the work in, put the love in, override the challenges and blockades and work with the community conflict to say like we are going to be a community. And that's important to us. I think when we gather in space and we are doing that for the sake of liberation work, for the sake of how that connects with our own cultures and traditions as a resourcing point, we are inherently saying, as Melanie K. Kantrowitz would say, like we are making home where we are, not like, oh, this is a compromise, but like this is thriving. This is the right thing. This is actually what is meant to be. What it means to be not wishing for a real or imagined place, but actually deciding to root in coalition with the place where I am, including First Peoples, immigrant peoples, plants, all the things that that means, which is another reason I love having the markets outside and I love doing them in coalition with other interfaith or cultural spaces, because I think that really speaks to what is happening here that is important and supportive that's already existing and saying that we're part of that.
There's something about what you do with the markets that really reminds me of the Bundist concept of national cultural autonomy, of the fact that we can just do this. We don't need to wait for some outside force to organize our own communities. We can just be here together and produce culture and demonstrate how our communities thrive rather than just imagining some other possibility, because we are all here. We already are seeing this stuff, and especially in the work that you do of, you said, gassing people up, of showing like, hey, you're doing some awesome stuff. Bring it to the community. I think there's something that's incredibly beautiful about that. It also kind of shows how you can challenge capitalism in a sense of like challenging, I mean, the Marxist term for what we were talking about, commodity fetishism, of treating this as like a relationship between things when it's a relationship between people. And there's something about the open market, as you do, that is really challenging that alienation that emerges through capitalism and instead says like, hey, we are all together. We are all people creating things that we can share with each other. And like, yeah, we're kind of constrained by the way capitalism structures all this and we need to be able to earn a living, but at the same time we can support each other in this. We can see the incredible work that each of us is doing and support each other in a way that does allow people to thrive without having to sell out to the system that we're all bound to.
Listeners who are turning in for the first time should be advised that we actually do not mention Marxism several times in each episode. It just turned out this time to be the case. I guess it's because we're talking so much about production and economics and commodities that, you know, what can you do? To stay a little bit more, because this is probably the first time since we've started recording the podcast that we actually speak with, when we were thinking about how to approach this question, there were several points, whether it's a business person or an entrepreneur or, you know, someone involved in that way. There's room here for wider discussion, whether on the left, ideas regarding entrepreneurship or management, not in a sense of like overseeing, but management in terms of logistics, are useful skill sets that should be emphasized more. But In terms of how Pushcart is organized, what does it mean for you in terms of the corporations that you have to organize the business in an ethical way? I mean, I know one of the selling points that you have as well is that what you do is BDS compliant. And so is that something that comes up with artists? Has there been tensions regarding that? And I guess we should combine this with what we also wanted to talk about, which is when we talk about our understanding of diasporism, there are different ways in which you can go about it. If you look at sort of the more traditional way of, for example, Professor Simon Dubnow, when he was writing in the early 20th century, he was a diasporist, I think it's right to say, but he also believed in diasporic centers to a large extent. He believed that, yes, Jews will live all over the world, but some communities will be more worthwhile than others. They'll be more able to fulfill Jewish culture and communal fulfillment. And he pointed either to Babylon or to Spain or to the Pale, the old country. And now we might make America be that case, because after all, the American Jewish community is much larger than all other Jewish communities in diaspora combined, at least by most nominal statistics. What we believe in here is quite different. We believe that every Jewish community around the world has value and should be supported as much as possible. So bearing in mind the practical and logistical difficulties of that, and if you can talk about how having so much traveling and schlepping things along, if we may, how do you approach this challenge of trying to be able to reach everyone whilst also knowing that there will be more people that will come to a market if it's done in, you know, Los Angeles than in, for the sake of our friends in Montana, let's say Montana.
Okay, there are a lot of questions in there. I try to write them down. But one thing you said at the beginning, you were asking me, like, is this a business? Are you an entrepreneur? What are you? And I think that like is really funny. And Ben's laughing and I was laughing while you were asking me, because it's like, at a certain point, it's like, who cares? And also like, it kind of is like coming right up against this truth that like, I need to eat food every day. I need an entity to receive money with. It's almost like funny because it's also absurd. It's like, I don't care. Like, I know what my work is. I feel so clear. And yet, like, yes, there needs to be a pathway for this to function in a falling apart system that is inherently exploitative. And so one way to sidestep your question or to like answer it beyond or outside of capitalism is to say that like, I have learned from my previous work at an organization called Link of Legal that one could say that what I'm doing is cultural organizing. So yes, it's organizing, it's mobilizing people, it's thinking about strategy, but instead of for the sake of closing a prison or electing a president, which both matter and have material consequences, we could argue that cultural organizing also has material consequences and is vital to the stability and health of a community or of a place. So that's one answer to that. And then I think there's like practical questions in what you asked me of like, how do you have an ethical business? Which like, I would say, I really love Damien Hadassah, who has a Jewish sounding name, but is actually not Jewish, who does some really cool work around like hacking the system of working for yourself, doing work that probably isn't categorized in the capitalist system while still making a living. And I look to her as my teacher in trying to make a living. And I say trying to because I actually do think it's so important to me that the artists that I work with get paid for their work. And it's also like important to me that I could make a living doing cultural organizing. And I don't really think that's something that is easy for people to understand or easy for people to open their pockets to, even though I think so many people love this project, they're like, what am I giving money to? Which both like I understand. And on the other hand, I'm like, yeah, look at all these markets, look at where I'm going, look at this retreat, like it's obvious where the money's going. And yet in the system we live in, I think it's really hard for people to understand what this is. And to feel subconsciously like, yeah, of course I should give to that in the same way that I should give to a farmer when I buy produce from them. So I think when I say ethical chains of production or ethical business, what it actually ends up being is a lot of education and framing around like what this is, why does it matter, where does the money go? And I think like another sidestepping title is that it's really like I am just like a schlepper. Like there's so much setting up tables and chairs, sound systems, bringing Judaica in and out, driving the truck across the country full of stuff. And there are days when it does feel like hard. And I'm like, there's not really enough money for gas here without going into more debt. And I think it's important to me like to say this project is succeeding, like look at all the impact it's made and look at who it's uplifted. But also to say like, there's not a financial model for this that feels useful. And to be honest about that, without being like, well, that means the project is something nobody wants, or like a capitalist evaluation where it's like, well, that means it's a failure. Like, actually, it's a success because it's a cultural project, and it sucks to monetize culture. And the question is, how do we like ethically compensate people for culture production and work? So it's a question I'm still in that I don't feel like I have a great answer to. I think that cultural organizing works on many scales. We could go to like Adrienne Marie Brown's like small is all emergent spiral, or you could just think of our own lives where like we have trying to honor Shabbat in our house. We have trying to celebrate a high holiday in our community, if we're lucky, with multiple people. And then we have wanting to go somewhere to meet people from different places. Like, there are so many scales on which, if we're thinking like relationally, which as my friends say, like Judaism is a team activity. Like, we obviously can have personal practices, but like we require 10 people to even have a full service. So like, I think it's a gift that we are commanded most of the time to be in groups to be able to fulfill and feel what it actually means to have most of our practices in a more full or more whole way. And so I am trying to meet people on those different scales in their lives. Like, if I cannot come to you because you live in a place where financially it would be challenging for me to make it there and be able to make up for that funding, there's an online store, or there's larger retreat and educational programs where people do fly from all across the country. People are doing things from like running their own arts organization to like working at Dunkin' Donuts and being like, I'm going to prioritize this time with other Jews. And maybe this is something I do twice a year, and maybe I've never done it before. And there is like a place for gathering in that way where people are coming from different places. And then there's like going and doing a market in a more populated place where I know that there will be some makers, and that on this ethical business level of compensation, they will sell enough to make it worth their time to produce those things and be at the market. And I will do the same and be able to compensate myself for the travel. But I'm grateful for you asking this question, because I think living in modern times in the United States and probably the UK or other similar countries, like, yeah, it's hard to organize one's life. You have to sacrifice a lot if you would like to organize your life around a de-assimilated Jewish practice. Like, if you want to live in walking distance to a shul or like a community, probably not even a shul, depending, that's going to be sacrificing something. Like, I honor people who make that choice. And I really empathize that it's not a choice everyone can make. It's actually a choice very few people can make to center their life around their Jewish community or Jewish practice. And so my question is like, how do I serve and support people who can't do that? Because it's actually the majority of people. So I feel like the online store and education and my ability to like be traveling in this not nostalgic pushcart way are ways that I try and reach for that. And I think underneath your question is actually in some ways like a grief or a lack that I don't want to pretend isn't there. And I don't want to have a toxic positive narrative that because I'm here, everything's fine. Like, it's not fine. I think there are people who are really lonely, and I talk to them a lot. They message me on the internet. I sometimes end up with them in conversation in group gathering spaces where I hear that this is truly the exception to their lives. And I'm not sure that that is something we can immediately change or change ever in the current context. And so I think our work, as we think about a non-nostalgic revitalization, is like, okay, what spaces exist then? And like the boom of like online programming, which is not necessarily part of my work the majority of the time, I think is like a beautiful example of revitalizing. Yes, we're using technology on Shabbat. There's hundreds of people in this Zoom room. So I think that is the question. And I want to be real that both in who I'm trying to support and the gaps there, and also like what people need and what I have access to offering, which I talked about a bit on the Judaism Unbound podcast. Like, people ask me for things and the way that they want them. I want it ethically sourced. I want it made by this person, and I want it on this material. The honest answer is no, that doesn't exist, and I'm so sorry. And just sitting with that of like, yeah, we can get there maybe. It's going to take time. We need mentorship. People need to master these skills. So just being honest that like there are gaps to fill, and there are some gaps that I don't know if they will be filled, and sitting with that is part of what this moment in revitalization is. It's like noticing what's left out and why.
Something that I thought of when you talked about the process of travels and visiting that came into mind is the very traditional Jewish petty trader idea, that being a dominant sector of the economy, or a dominant presence of Jews in many places in Eastern Europe in that aspect of the economy, the one that was open to them, and the reasons as to why that changed, and also how in Poland after the Second World War, for Jewish Holocaust survivors, there was this idea that petty trade was no longer acceptable for the regime and that they needed to be made productive. There was a big discourse on productivization, not just from the Stalinist regime. There was a lot of discourse on this in the Jewish community as well. And this is too broad of a subject here, but I think it's interesting how the perspective of that, while it's not economically productive in the sense of making as much product as possible, you nevertheless keep something important in the products that you do make and you do sell.
I haven't thought about that term petty trader, but as you described it, I was thinking about the history of pushcarts, actually, and what has been called the sanitization of New York and the Lower East Side. And I'm blanking on his name right now. I'm like, should I quickly Google it or let it go? Basically, like the pushcart thriving street life that existed was squelched under the guise of health and sanitation. There was like a gradual process where like people knew that there would be an uprising if they immediately said, you can't have this anymore, because it was, like you said, the center of people's social lives. But what they did was corral them all into one indoor market and then eventually phase out that indoor market, which is now like a gentrified indoor fancy restaurant space across the street from the original place where they corralled everyone. And just to say that, like, I think what you're pointing to is that like culture and relational projects are not monetizable. That's not the lines on which they function. And for that reason, they're devalued. However, that doesn't mean they're not central to human life. And just seeing that pattern play out across time and different places literally was striking to me as you were speaking.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the next step from that is the removal of shops on streets and putting them into big box shopping malls at the edges of cities. Again, back to car culture. And sometimes I think of Kazimierz being very, very dominant on tourist and gastronomy sectors. And then there's a shopping mall that is just about 10, 15 minutes away from everything else, completely isolated. And that's where you have the bookshop, the cinema, a lot of clothes shops, you know, and then everyone has to go by car instead of them being on the street. Since we're already talking about on the streets, I feel a little bit bad about asking for this, but I'll do it anyway. With all the logistical difficulties of hauling a truck across the continental United States, when is pushcart making the hop across the Atlantic?
Great question. Don't feel bad about it. I love that question because it's saying that international connection is important and vital to the project of cultural building, which I believe is true for Jews and also across Jews as we think about what's happening right now on the global stage. Of course, international politics are so important. And as you said, perhaps the United States Jewry is the center of the most dense Jewish population. And I'm like, yes, but like when I want the fall of empire to happen, like I'm going to need to be talking to some people who don't live where I live, who can see this place through the lens of their own cultural landscape and bring important critiques and viewpoints. So that's like a broader way of saying, of course, it's so important to me to be in connection with international culture building around the revival of Judaism. I was doing a very small market this past weekend and someone was like, these are for you. They had been waiting to deliver me the Shabbos 24/7 zines from Belgium for like 6 months. And it was like a beautiful way of giving them to me because it was kind of like punk mail, because like shipping things is so expensive. I also have a sweet relationship with Miknaf Haaretz in the UK, and I finally, like in the last month, received their zines, their homeland zine and their Shemitah cycle land stewardship and Judaism zine. So I feel like it is small potatoes, but there are ways in which I'm working to get international art and culture into the online store, and also like working with Miknaf Haaretz on some of the educational stuff I'm doing. So I think your question of like, when am I going to go and hop the pond? I mean, we got to talk, Zach, I'm ready. But in certain ways, there are, on those smaller scales that we're talking about, it's so important to me to be connected. And I'm excited to see my new friend Misha from Pink Peacock, which closed in the next month. So I feel like those relationships are budding. And the question of connecting outside of the US is, I feel like, a live question that I want people like you to be thinking about with me, because it deeply matters.
Yeah, thank you for that. We were joking around posing that question. It's like, when are you coming to Poland? Because Zach really wanted you to come visit.
Let's go to Poland. I mean, there's probably some really amazing cultural work that needs to happen with the people who are drawn to this project. Yeah. I'm ready. It's a money thing. It's like, how many suitcases of my Judaica am I petty traveling with?
I was wondering if you had time for one more question. Because I know you do some offerings of educational programming, and I was kind of wondering if you could say a little bit about what you explore in that programming, and then kind of what that says about like the larger vision of where you dream that this work might take you and the world more broadly.
Beautiful. Thank you for asking about educational programming, because in a world of one soundbite, it's hard to remember the complexity of every project, including mine, which is that it's not just an online store. So I'm grateful that you are uplifting the educational pieces of my work. I would say the smallest scale is like, okay, I want a relationship with matzah. That means that I'm not going to go to the big box grocery store and buy the nasty matzah. I want to make it myself. So like we did a matzah bake where like we didn't have a kosher facility, but we like timed it out and followed the halacha to make it kosher with the leavening rising process. And then people had matzah to take home. And we did that outside on like this land that's owned by some lesbian elders in like a wood-fired oven. And I feel like we were in relationship with land and people who matter here to make our matzah. People came from very far north in New York. People came from close to the city, people where I live. So we kind of gather to make matzah. That's one example. I run like soul candle programming, like thinking about the Jewish year and like what is needed to be with the Jewish cycles of time. Soul candles are something that happens typically around the new year in the Jewish calendar. So that's a program that I run. And then on a larger scale, a few months ago, we just finished a retreat called L'Shem Kedushat, which is like for the sake of holiness, which is a phrase that is said in the making of a lot of Jewish ritual objects, particularly waf, the parchment made for Torah. And that retreat brought people from across the so-called United States together to gain mentorship in cloth making so that this skill can get passed down in what Julie Seltzer calls the spiritual self-sufficiency of a community. Like, okay, maybe you want this for political reasons. Maybe you want it because of your relationship to land and ethical land-based practices and sourcing. And maybe you actually are interested in it as part of your spiritual practice, that like spiritual self-sufficiency. Not self-sufficient, like I do it alone, but like we can do it. We know how to do it. So that was a four-day program that was really beautiful. We stretched some hides, sanded a different hide. It was like a cooking show where the cloth animal hides were at different stages, and we worked on each stage with Rabbi Linda Motzkin, who runs the community Torah project in so-called Saratoga, New York, so not so far away. And then the larger scale, when we zoom out even more, a project that I am not going to necessarily complete in the recent time, but is one that is super near to my heart and that I hear very strongly as a need from the people I work with, is inspired by Rabbi Lynn Gottlieb's Storytelling Guild, the revival of the political social sphere of the guild, which is one in which craft people and artisans are brought together along the lines of their specific craft to support each other. And I have talked to weavers, I am connected to candle makers, I'm connected to sofer scribes, people who are on WhatsApp and signal threads and email chains. And to me, that's beautiful. And it's great that we have connection. And I'm interested in what it would look like for us to be able to talk within our craft, as well as in the different pieces that we need for our craft. For example, where does the weaver get their wool? Who cards the wool? How can we be connected to more phases of the creation of a thing? And also, like, what does it mean for us to support each other across crafts? Because even though we're making different things and we need different expertise, we are facing similar challenges around the value of the work we do, compensation, mentorship, learning cultural practices that are not just Ashkenazi, Ashkenormative. There's a lot that we need each other for. So one of my biggest bird's eye view dreams is supporting this guild and also the creation of materials, like manuals, basically, not to codify things that we already have halacha and laws that have been written thousands of years ago, but okay, today, where could you get at the hardware store to make this thing? How do you do that? Because people have already figured that out. And it's a place where we could do a little bit more to support each other instead of just, I know someone who knows someone and maybe I'll get my hands on the Google Doc, like what could a short publication for different crafts look like. So those are some fun things on the horizon. And before I reach you, we'll be at the new Jewish Craft School of New York opening on August 18th. And the Jewish Currents is having a cultural festival September 15th, I believe. And the Jewish Museum of Chicago is doing a really cool exhibition opening from their fellowship in September. So those are some places I'll be before I reach you in the sunny state over there, Ben.
Spoken like a true salesman. You didn't even have to ask for shout outs.
Yeah, no. Thank you so much for coming, Ollie. I really enjoyed the way you kind of weaved between culture and the economics. It kind of went in the direction I didn't think about with the guilds. I think that's a really fascinating idea that kind of links really nicely to episodes 20 and 21 about workplace organizing and the labor movement in a way that I think we hadn't thought about with guilds and the social space that that creates. I think that's a really beautiful vision, and I really love that you shouted out Miknaf Haaretz and Shabbos 24/7, who we interviewed in episodes 9 and 10. It's really wonderful to kind of see the sort of networks that already exist and the sort of diasporist internationalism that is always in the process of becoming. So thank you so much for joining us today, Ali. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you all. I'm so grateful for the work you're doing.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sing for joy.